Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice of our founder and mentor, Brian Brown. Until his death last January 18th, Brian presided over a team of commentators known as the Brieflies. We continue Brian's legacy of edified civil discourse, leavened hopefully with goodwill and humor. I am Bruce Hallman. I come from the ultra-liberal village of Ellisport, which is situated on the east side of Vachon above KVI Beach and Point Hire. Ultra-liberal comes from the Seattle Times, who called Vachon ultra-liberal about a year ago. And so I've taken that for Ellisport as our sort of village theme, if you will. Joining me today are five more Brieflies. First, at the controls in our state-of-the-art bustling downtown Vachon Gene Bosch studio is our mood-modulating sound engineer, Truman O'Brien.
Good.
Fresh from the Tuesday morning scramble with his daughter, Molly O'Brien, and indefatigable in his dealing with his Trump-supporting ex-Army buddies.
Well,
what are your Trumpster friends saying about the election?
Well, you know, what I said to them this morning was, I said, well, fellas, you know, with about 80% turnout that we're getting in the country right now, whoever wins this darn thing wins it. That's all there is to it. We just got to take it and go with it. Mm-hmm. Either way it goes. You know, I mean, there's just nothing else to do.
Are they responding?
They agreed. They agreed. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're getting a huge turnout in this country. It's unbelievable. I mean, last I saw, it's like 80%. I mean, I don't think that's ever happened.
Yeah,
you'll know, Bruce, but I think that's just phenomenal. I mean, I'm delighted.
So they're not ready to grab their guns and go into the streets?
I don't think so. One of them did say, well, we'll see how many cities are on fire tonight. But, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. By the way, thanks for that introduction, but I was a little bit, things are a little exciting around here. You aren't aware of it, but someone had logged out of Zoom. We log in under Kate's, our wonderful executive director's sign in. And I thought, oh my gosh, she told me what it was, but it's been 2 weeks ago. I've slept since then. And so I was sending her these messages going, help, help, they're about to come on. And suddenly the lights came on and I remembered. So there we are.
Truman, I think I've learned that airline pilot talk, when they say exciting, it means tighten your seatbelt and hope you don't crash.
Well, yeah, that's probably the correct parlance for that.
Okay. You are on the radio.
Indeed. Well, listen, what I've always said, you know, a friend of mine once said, you know, we were really late on a meeting, a deadline and everything. And he goes, oh my gosh. He said, you were so calm in this emergency. And I said, well, you know, we weren't on fire and nobody was going to die. It wasn't an emergency, you know? It's just the way it is.
Exactly. Joining us on Zoom is that rare feminist who grew up in the Deep South before journeying back to the far Pacific Northwest, is academic artist and provocateur Lynn Kerrigan. Ooh. Lynn, what is your clear and now contract cataract lenses see happening today?
Oh my gosh, I'm trying to delay any media check-ins. You know, I've been thinking about the media, both how much a double sword it is. You know, we're so lucky to be able to get so much information so fast. And yet the so much has been making my acid reflux come back. So I'm on a media diet. I think we have to remember, you know, Truman, what you were saying about your friends seem more tempered than what we see on the news. And I think it's important to remember that the journalists have a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. Meaning, you know, they make money. The more conflict they report and the more extreme their reporting is. And so we hope to give you a dose of a mild humor and silliness as well as erudition today.
Dale, you had...
Oh, I was just going to add, Lynn, I came across a great article in the New York Times yesterday talking about how to deal with the stress.
And I saw that.
There are a couple of things they said. You know, the tendency is to cancel everything. They said, no, schedule things to do that actually will help reduce your stress. Allow for your feelings, you know, like let yourself, if you feel scared for a moment and take it in. And denying them or pushing them away actually creates more tension. And finally, give yourself something to look forward to in the immediate future. So
I have my bottle of scotch out and some ice cream in the freezer.
Oh, scotch floats. Right. Yum.
I'm choosing to make a celebration dinner tonight. And, you know, that the nightmare may be nearly over.
The Mountaineers hiking climbing club in Seattle has what they call the 10 essentials, the 10 essential things you take on any hike, you know, water, map, you know, all those kind of things, snack, all that sort of stuff. But I think we need the two essentials, alcohol and ice cream.
That works for me.
So also zooming in is erudite, but still half a bubble short of plum, carpenter, landscape artist, actor, singer, and wannabe baseball fan. After all, he does barrack for the Mariners, Michael Shook. Michael, is this going to be a Mariners election? A lot of hope at the end and a lot of heartbreak at the end?
Well, you know, I think everybody just wants to pull for the team and contribute in whatever way they can, and they're going to do their best. You know, they're all team players. You know, that's that horrible thing all players say. Our listener can't see, but I'm wearing my good luck Brooklyn Dodgers hat, and I think it's a good omen that a week ago today, the Los Angeles Dodgers, the heirs to the Brooklyn throne there, won their World Series championship in this oddly truncated season. So I took that as a very good omen. So I'm confident. I have my bottle of 2015 Syrah that I've already tapped into today. It's noon somewhere. And that's one of my 10 essentials. I always, when I go climbing, I would always carry along wine.
Noon, why wait?
Well, sometimes you need that little extra courage, you know?
Right.
So tell us a little bit about how the Dodgers got their name, and is that appropriate on this election day?
Well, yes. My understanding is that the old field that they first began playing on, there were trolley lines going through the back part of it. And people who are pretty diehard baseball fans understand that in the old days, and we're talking back in the early 1900s, the back section of baseball fields across the nation were just open, and they sometimes would close it off with ropes, but sometimes there would be things like that, trolley cars going through the outfield at the far reaches. So it's I've also heard that in Brooklyn there were so many lines of trolleys that to get to the ballpark, you had to zigzag across them and dodge them. So I'm unclear as to which is the truer story there, but either one makes a good one.
Right. They all involve trolley cars and they all involve dodging them.
Definitely.
Zooming in and representing Indivisible Vashon is progressive activist Kevin Jones, now known nationally as a quote unquote volunteer, because of his incredible work during this election, sending cards and appeals to voters in swing states. Kevin, will your efforts pay off in these critical swing states?
Boy, you know, we were just asked by our national coordinator how many voter contacts we think Indivisible Vashon has made in this election session. And if we count Vashon Serge showing up for racial justice, who teamed with us, I think we're literally around 12 million. And that's sort of on the low side. When you think about texting, where you can send out like, you know, 10,000 text messages in a few hours, the numbers can go up pretty bad. I would say, yeah, things are going to be quite interesting. I'd say the third essential is patience. And we're really making sure that we know it's not election night, it's election week. We need to make sure those ballots get counted. But, you know, there's tons of stuff going on. At 6 o'clock, Indivisible Vashon starts our election watch gathering. Mm-hmm. 7 o'clock, Kate and Doug are on Voice of Vashon right here with their election watch. And at 8 o'clock p.m., our Vashon ballot box monitor, Noah Roselander, will be calling into Voice of Vashon for the official closing of the polls and the official starting of the count. And then between 8:15 and 8:45, Kate tells me that Joe Fitzgibbon and Eileen Cody will be calling in. And sometime during the 3 hours they'll be on the air, Pramila Jayapal apparently has just said that she's going to call in sometime, but we don't know when. So there's so many things to do to just sort of be involved and keep track of what's happening today. So I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Gail.
Kevin, how do we tune in to your Indivisible Vashon event tonight?
The best way to do that is to go to our website, indivisiblevashon.org. And I am crossing my fingers that we have that event listed. I'll double check it, but I'm pretty sure that we do. You have to register for it. It'll be a Zoom. You know, drop in, say hi, go somewhere else, come back. We're probably going to be there until midnight and hopefully posting how things are going when we start to hear results. How are we doing on that path to the White House? And how are we doing on that path to the U.S. Senate? And so I hope to be posting stuff on our online over the course of the evening.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Looking forward to it. So recently returned to Vashon after a sojourn on Orcas and Lopez Islands, two other Salish Sea islands with their own peculiarities. Vashon has our own peculiarities, of course, where she landed hoping to escape to Canada before they closed the borders, but didn't make it, is mystic muse and wandering poet and author Gail Kellner. Gail, you have a poem about voting you wanted to share with us.
Yes. Some of you may know Alfred, I think it's pronounced Lamotte, it's spelled L-A-M-O-T-T-E. And he wrote this lovely poem called Election Day. I'm going to just read a few of my favorite stanzas. It says, election, I voted. I voted for the cry of a loon. I voted for demonic mushrooms in the loam and the old democracy of worms. I voted for the local, the small, the brim that does not spill over. The abolition of waste, the luxury of enough. I voted for the commonwealth of ancient forests. I voted for open borders between death and birth. And I think anyone interested in hearing that or reading that again could find it. It's called, look up six poems. Again, that was Alfred Lamont.
Thank you.
I love the line there. That was lovely. First of all, and the whole thing, but what jumped out at me was the old democracy of earthworms.
Yeah.
I love that because they're such a simple organism. And I read one time, and I forget the number, but there's in an acre of good land that hasn't been treated with pesticide to death, there are millions, literally millions of earthworms in just 1 acre of ground. And these humble creatures, each one doing its job, create living soil or part of that biosphere. It just, I love that. Talk about grassroots or groundswell democracy. It's great.
So we're looking at today as election day, or as Kevin says, election week. Although I suspect by later this evening, we'll know how Florida, North Carolina, Arizona, and Colorado, Washington State, a few other key states have gone. Kevin, what's your prognostication?
You know, there's the polling data is so convincing, right, that we will have a new president after the votes are counted. And I do believe that Joe Biden is clearly going to win the popular vote. There's almost no doubt about that at this point. We're also wounded by what happened in 2016, right? We're all on pins and needles. But I can tell you that The Economist says that there's a 96% chance that Joe Biden will win. The 538 says there's an 89% chance. There's an 81% chance, according to The Economist, that the Senate, U.S. Senate, will change from red to blue. however, there are so many voter suppression efforts. I was texting all morning. We're going to switch over to a state where they are telling us that there's some lack of turnout and voter suppression things going on. So we're going to try to text to get people moving in that state. There's just so many things that can sort of get in the way of people being able to cast their vote. But if this election turns out to be more free and fair than constrained and suppressed, I'm quite convinced that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be in the White House in January.
Lynn?
It's kind of hard for me to trust the polls because, due to a background in kind of psychology and social work, I know that people often don't do what they say they're going to do. They often respond to questions with what you might want to hear or what they don't want to get into an argument about. And I think that, you know, we've come to rely a lot on the polls because we like to feel in control. You know, we like to not deal with so much anxiety and uncertainty, and polling has been a way to kind of get ahead of the game a little bit. So personally, I hope the polls are right, but I rarely listen to them. I think I read more about different points of view and try to, you know, listen to politicians and their commentators get into the issues about what seems to be most resonant, you know, with a different part of the country, and see if there's any indication that anything is a groundswell of earthworms.
Yep. Michael Moore brought that up. That's a really good point, Lynn. And I hadn't thought of it quite the way you stated, as far as the psychology of it. And those polls can be comforting. It does help kind of lower the anxiety level. But Michael Moore cautioned folks. I read something, a comment from him a couple of days ago, and he said, there's a lot of people on the right who are very reluctant, who just won't answer polls. And so they tend to be undercounted.
Exactly.
He was saying, cut those numbers in half, which I was, that did not lower my anxiety.
So it is quite intriguing. There's a woman, Rachel Bitticofer, or Bitticofer, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce her name. She apparently called very accurately the 2018, which was a blue wave. She doesn't look at polling data. She looks at demographics. She looks at cultures. She looks at sort of beliefs and values, and how do you put that together? And she has said now months ago, like 6 or 9 months ago, that the Democrats, they didn't have a candidate. The Democrats will win this election. So it is certainly fraught with risk to think that the pollsters know the answer. Another analysis that I saw recently said that if the polls are as wrong today as they were 4 years ago, given where the numbers are now, the numbers are still favoring the Democrats and still favoring a shift in the Senate. Now, having said all that, I don't know a single person who says, oh, I can sit back and do nothing. I got up at 7 o'clock this morning and I've been texting all day long. And if you have the chance to do that, that's what we need to do. Because Bitekofer's prediction was based on us doing everything we need to get people out to the polls. So we need to do all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gail.
And really good article, Kevin, in the Beachcomber last week. I really appreciated, you know, you're driving that point home. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was just going to say that it's kind of PTSD, you know, from 4 years ago. And I think all of us are suffering from that. In that same article I talked about earlier by Charlie Wazell, I believe, he said he likened our situation to the entire country waiting for the results of a biopsy all at once. And that there's a certain, psychologically, there's a certain defensive pessimism that we hold because we don't want it to hurt so badly if we're wrong. But speaking with another psychologist that was quoted in the paper was very interesting. They said, well, the problem with defensive pessimism is that you can suffer twice. Because you suffer ahead of time in anticipation that it's not going to go well. And then if it doesn't go well, of course, that feeling of deep loss.
My problem.
And so their thought, this woman's thought was, go ahead, just, you know, you only have to lose once. If you go ahead and be positive or at least neutral, that you only have to lose once if indeed it doesn't go the way many of us hope it will.
Truman, I was wondering about your friends from your Army days who are Trump supporters. You know, if Trump loses, what do they think is the future of Trump and the future of Trumpism? And who are they going to vote for in the next election?
Well, what's interesting is there is no question in their mind that he's going to win. So that's not even a question for them. They're just certain that Trump's going to win, and that's all there is to it. So they're not even thinking about it. I mean, seriously.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. You know, I heard an analysis of that, which basically said that if you are in the conservative media bubble, that is exactly what you hear all the time, and that what that sets up is the narrative that the election was stolen and that the election results are fraudulent. And while in the real world, I like to say, you know, we see polling data which clearly indicates that's not the likely outcome. And if you listen to the major news media, right, which has been branded fake, you know, you don't hear that kind of story. But if you live in that news bubble, that's where your belief system is. And the fear, of course, is that that is exactly what will prompt people to say that the election's stolen and not to believe the results and lose faith in our democracy. So it's really sad how these media and this rhetoric has essentially denigrated our democratic principles as a consequence.
Michael.
It's interesting the what you said about the conservative or the right bubble. For the last few months, or maybe even a little longer, I subscribe to the National Review's daily updates. I don't want to pay for a subscription, but I get to read different articles and things like that. And it's fascinating to me because here's a magazine that, of course, was William F. Buckley Jr. started and has been one of the standard bearers of conservatism for the last, I don't know what, 60, 70 years. It's been surprising. I've been disappointed to find that it has become every bit as slanted and as biased as anything I've read in a far left one. I do read occasionally articles and commentaries that will address things in a pretty even-handed manner and make some really good points. Because Lord knows the left and the Democrats or progressives, whatever you want to call them, are, you know, far from perfect. And we, you know, sometimes really do some stupid things. And they call them on that, which I appreciate. But so does my Harper's Magazine. People think it's just a narrow lane magazine, but they've written blistering articles over the years about every president since I've subscribed to it, from Jimmy Carter right on through to Barack Obama. And it doesn't matter whether they're Democrat or Republican. So it's interesting. That media bubble there, and I don't know how many of your friends, Truman, read the National Review or if they bother with anything like that.
No.
Too highbrow or something, yeah. I suppose. Yeah. But it's just fascinating to me that it's just as out of touch in a lot of ways, or skewed, as anything I've ever read.
Well, and William F. Buckley is probably rolling over in his grave. I mean, that sort of 1950s, you know, William F. Buckley conservatism was a very different kind of conservatism than we have today. You know, I mean, it was internationalist. It was, you know, business oriented. And it wasn't this kind of populist based racial and cultural kind of antagonism that we see from the right today. And it's a fascinating transition that's taken place over the last 50, 60 years in the very structure of right-wing conservatism in the United States. And they've sort of have focused on a couple major issues, abortion being one of them, and the welfare state being another one, but also on this sort of attitude of being displaced or being forgotten. And it's what has powered Trump beginning in the 90s with Newt Gingrich and that sort of angry sort of Republican response that has taken over the Republican Party. What I find fascinating to think about is what are all of those, what I call the Dan Evans Republicans, those sort of moderate Republicans who, you know, dominated electoral politics in Washington State for 30 or 40 years in the post-World War II period. Where are they going to go? Because the current Republican Party, the Donald Trump Republican Party, is not a party that's comfortable for those people. Kevin, any thoughts?
Well, I a couple of thoughts. You know, we if you're tuned into the local news, I believe it was in Olympia that a number of folks from the conservative side of the political spectrum were showing up with rallies and basically some what was viewed as intimidation by people trying to get to the polls. You can really see the narrative would prompt people to do that. The long-term outcome is unknown right now. Right? We have to decide what the results of this election are, and then how do we move towards bringing people together. I know when we're doing a lot of conversations over text, and you know, you'll always get the angry reply of, you know, heck no, I'm not, I don't want to vote for your candidate. Or if any time that kind of reply gives us an opening, I look forward to a dialogue to talk about where we find commonality and where maybe we can find points that I can help share information from my perspective that might lend a different perspective to a person who's contemplating how they're going to cast their vote. I think we need to do more of that. But right now, it's really easy to be driven apart.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, you grew up in Georgia. You know, I grew up in Northwest Florida. I've been in contact over the years with friends back there. Georgia's moving into the potential of a swing state. What do you hear from your friends back there?
Well, most of my friends that I still have, I would say, are far on the liberal wing. But I certainly have family members that I think are very conservative in the old school sense that you both have talked about, which was not so hateful. I think I want to go there because the South, when I grew up there, was the Bible Belt, and people kind of balanced these odd emotions of being pretty serious about their religion, but with giant blind spots about slavery and civil rights and things that have, you know, come to define Atlanta anyway, and the area where I was became very liberal because the blacks moved into Atlanta and started voting in mass, regardless of voter intimidation. And so where I grew up was very liberal comparatively to the rest of the South. And so I think when you said that the alternative to polls, Kevin, is to look at demographics, I think that's really what I've seen, is that the people who are in sort of the city areas of almost anywhere tend to go a little bit more toward human rights and jobs for people, and try to finesse, you know, a lot of the emotional differences. I don't know. I hope Georgia does swing back to where it was when I was a youth, when it was still pretty Democratic. It went Republican, you know, for Reagan, I think.
So
Truman, go ahead.
Yeah, I just have a question. You said something that made me think. People in the cities, I think you did. You say people in the cities tend to be a little bit more liberal or more. Whereas
I think they have voted more liberal, yes.
And I'm wondering if it's because of the fact that you're rubbing shoulders with everybody all the time. And so, therefore, they are much more in your face and very much more in your mind. Where the people out that are rural don't do that. And so they're much more independent.
That's true.
You think? Never really thought about that. Gail?
Yeah, I've been curious about that question myself too, Truman, and wondered what effect that has, that there's a more of a sense of us when our when we have many more neighbors that don't necessarily look like us or have the same, you know, share the same religion, that the us may be expanded in that circumstance. The other thing that I've noticed in traveling, is particularly most recently in Iowa, was that the countryside, the outside of the cities, is where the wealth is. This is where the big houses are. This is where the fancy cars are. Wealth is outside of the cities, where most of the cities are, by standards of the coast, quite impoverished. So it's a very difference. There's a tendency here or on the coast that many people, may perhaps not right now in the pandemic, but in general, many people, wealthy people, do choose to live in cities for the cultural experiences. And that isn't the case in the middle parts of the country, in my observation.
I have to tell you, on Sunday, I was in Eastern Washington and visiting with some friends there, and they commented that the land prices have just skyrocketed. They have like tripled. And because of the pandemic and the decentralization and the work from home and all of the things that are happening around the pandemic, people are wanting to get out of the city, get away from other people. And they can do that now because they can work at home or they can do things, you know. And so they are buying up
land.
That's
a huge, yeah, the pandemic has offered
really
a huge shift in that.
Right.
I'm actually very curious at how that will affect elections and demographics, particularly of counties and states in the coming year.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, though, I don't believe that it's true in Georgia anyway, that the wealth is in the rural areas. There was certainly white flight from Atlanta in the 60s and 70s. And so the metropolitan Atlanta area, that is true for, where the wealthy people are not so much in the city, but in the surrounding suburbs. But the rural part of Georgia is gutted. When I was there and drove from Atlanta to Savannah for my last vacation with my cousins in 2014, I'd never seen anything like it. I was horrified. There is not wealth. And when I moved to Connecticut as a 21-year-old, I think, from Atlanta, I was shocked to see what you said, you know, that the farther out from the major cities, you saw more and more will. So I
think and my experience is not so much the South. The South, I did see a lot of poverty. My travels there, I've seen a lot of poverty, rural poverty in the South as well as in the cities. But in the Midwest, it seems to be, the cities seem to be places where you see less wealth, where you see people who are struggling more, and it's the outlying areas where you see the wealth.
Michael, what are your carpenter friends, you know, the guys in the union, what are they saying at this point? Are you in touch with many of them? Or
most of the guys that I, you know, that I keep in touch with were pretty darned on the left side of things, you know, solidly Democrats. We always marveled that how could a guy, especially a union carpenter, vote for someone who wanted to just take apart unions as fast as they could. Mm-hmm. Truman, what'd you...
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, one of the other groups that I keep track of on Facebook are pilots. And it's a particular group that pilots against Trump, which I think is kind of interesting. But these guys are always talking about, oh, man, I flew with this guy the other day that was just, you know, over the top Trump supporter. And he said, and I can't even talk to him. I mean, many of them have said that they can't talk to these people because they're just, you know, so dyed in the wool. But they tried to say things about the, you know, airlines. ALPA is a huge union with the airlines and a very important union. I was an ALPA member for 20 plus years, and the things that they've accomplished are just mind-boggling. I mean, in terms of safety and scheduling and all that kind of stuff. But these guys who are big Trump supporters don't even see that. It's like it's another world or something. It's very interesting.
Airline Pilots Association, right, Drew?
Yeah, ALPA, Airline Pilots.
I think there's a kind of a break in there somewhere because the guys that I've worked with who are more conservative, and we did have discussions in the lunchroom and everything about this kind of stuff. There's a kind of a break between their love of all the union benefits and the wage scale and safe working conditions and overtime pay, all these things. And then there's this other part of them that just feels like, you know, I just really want the government to keep its nose out of my business. And a lot of them felt like there was too much overreach on the part of government in terms of, they're trying to tell my kids this in school, or they are emphasizing that as a way of life that's appropriate, and I don't think that's so, and what does my voice count for? I'm the parent. There's a real kind of digging in the heels resentment about that sort of stuff. So it's kind of a split there.
That's the same thing that I'm talking about, Michael. It's the same feeling.
So I recently encountered some article talking about historians as a general group of being quite often liberal and progressive. I don't know, has that been your experience with your community? And what are they saying?
I miss that. Is that for me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Most historians tend to be fairly liberal, not all. I mean, there's a lot of conservative historians, but most of them are relatively, they see the long game, if you will. And when you see the long game, you see things like Trump as an aberration, certainly a response to forces in American society that have been there for a long time, really since the end of the Cold War, and sort of a growing resentment with the changes in American culture. But, you know, this is in the long run, this is temporary. A couple of election cycles from this, the arguments will be very different because you won't have a Trump. You'll have Trump surrogates, but they will fall out of favor. It is my sense. And that's what a lot of historians are saying. Lynn.
You know, I've been reading Jill Lepore's book, This America, The Case for the Nation, and she's a historian at Harvard. I think I misquoted her background once as Yale, but it's Harvard. She's a Harvard historian. And her book is very thought-provoking for me because she connects some dots, and that's what this conversation is about, being able to hold two different feelings at once, you know, the ambiguity that we all feel about different aspects of an election or about our society. But she made a really interesting point for me that I hadn't considered, which was that she thought historians had missed the mark in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years by going down the documentation of all of the identity politics and rights issues that has come up, as opposed to the national narrative, to try to look at what is it that binds us together now, regardless of all of these different aspects and concerns and swirling emotions about our lives in this country. And she felt like the liberal elite has never really addressed sort of structural racism or some of the displacement issues from globalization. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty brave of her as a historian to do some critiques of how the attempt to kind of wind everything up into a readable linear narrative, sure, you know, can give blind eyes to us all, where sure, we take what we want, all of us, from our lives and ignore, you know, some of the perils that we've walked into.
So it's just so much more messy than we want it to be. That when you were saying that line from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, he was speaking ostensibly about himself, but I'm sure he was also writing about America. With, you know, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. You know, I am large. I contain multitudes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then what Lepore is sort of at the leading edge of a group of historians who are sort of reacting against postmodernism that emerged in the 60s and 70s and sort of began to fragment history and look at, and very importantly, to look at individual stories and stories of displaced groups and those kind of things. And it's been powerful to do that, but at the same time, you miss that overarching narrative, the sort of Herodotus kind of history that tries to look at the big picture. So it's an interesting sort of a pendulum swing that we see going on right now.
Yeah.
We've only got a couple minutes left, one or two at the most. So maybe before we end, we can just pop around real quick and just see how you think the election's going to come out. What's your prediction? And then, Gail, you have a poem for us to end the show. So, Truman, who's going to win?
You know, I hate to stick it out there, but you know, I have a feeling Biden's going to do it. By the way, I do have one quick announcement. We have had a formal resignation from Susan McCabe, who we really appreciate and thank for coming in. And since Gail was one of the original members of the Briefly, she's come back, and Susan has decided that she's going to go ahead and pursue other things and let Gail take her slot, her original slot back. So anyway, we want to say thanks to Susan.
Yes, definitely. Thanks, Susan. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Real quick, I'm going to say that I trust Joe Biden is going to win the popular vote, but I'm very uncertain about the Electoral College and its minority rule. I really am worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Michael. I'm going all in. Rogers. Rogers win equals Biden-Harris blue Senate.
Kevin.
I'm all in with you, Michael. I will say that the election watch gathering, 6 p.m., Indivisible Vashon's Facebook page is where you can find the registration data.
Great. Gail.
Well, if we have time.
Yes.
No? Okay. I'll save it for next week.
Okay. So who's going to win?
Oh, I decided to just put it all out there too. I'm making lemon bars and quiche and champagne.